そういうね。
そういうね。忍者、忍
者ね。でね、でっぱり綺麗ですよ。I said, from Mongolia. He says, looks a lot like the one in India. I said, probably carried from India to Mongolia, not back. We reached the third turn of the wheel, didn't we? Okay? Finish the second one, onto the third one. So in the other turnings of the wheel, we discussed the primary student, or the student for whom the turning of the wheel was particularly designed, which is called Chirujar Ducha. And then secondly, we mentioned the primary subject matter. So we'll go ahead with the third turning of the wheel, and again, do that. We'll identify the main student that the third turning of the wheel was designed for, and then we'll get into the primary subject matter. And then don't forget that we'll have those four same characterizations, but flopped over, pancaked over, so that they're negative. So instead of having has something better, it'll be nothing better than it. Instead of there is an opening, it'll be there's no opening. Instead of figurative, it'll be literal. And instead of there's a point of contention, they'll say there is no point of contention. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Yes. This particular section of the third turning of the wheel will be treated in the original text as quoted in this text on page 28, starting on line 2 and continuing up to line 9, where the line begins Sung So.
Yes.
It's the same jumping off point as in the second turning of the wheel. Okay, so if you talk about starting point or subject matter from which we have to speak in the third turning of the wheel, it's the same five elements. First we have the Buddha saying the nature of things is impossible, the birth of things is impossible, the stopping of them is impossible. They are from the very beginning, total peace. And fifthly, they are transcendent. Or they have gone. They have a nature of having gone completely beyond grief. So those will be the same five starting points, or jumping off points, or basis, which forms those things which form the basis of our discussion.
Mm-hmm.
These five elements, which are doesn't have a nature of existing, right? And then doesn't have a nature of being born, doesn't have a nature of stopping, is from the beginning very peace and has gone beyond grief. In the second turning on the wheel, all of these expressions are relating directly to mainly to the fact that things don't exist by definition, right? So mainly the Buddha was talking about things don't exist by definition. Then when you get into the third turning of the wheel, they are not meaning exactly the same thing. They are involved with the three groupings, right? We've got the three groupings of things which are, constructs, things which are dependent on others, and things which are emptiness or totality. And now these same phrases that were used in the second turning of the wheel are being used in the third turning of the wheel with a slightly different flavor. They can't be used in exactly the same way. So when we say that we're using the same five expressions in the third turning of the wheel, you have to be sensitive to the fact that we're using them in a slightly different way, because otherwise they don't work, right? They don't fit, especially with regard to the three groups. For example, in the first one, you can say they don't exist by definition, but with only some of the groups. And with regard to the second one, you can say its birth doesn't have existence by definition. But then what your meaning is with regard to changing things, or to shenwang, right, to things which depend on others, you're not saying anymore that it means by definition meaning what it meant before. Now you're saying without its own causes and conditions. You see what I mean? So each one of these each one of these features or characterizations doesn't mean exactly the same thing when you get to the third turning of the wheel when it did in the second turning of the wheel, and it can't. So you yourselves can understand, if you can remember, because we went over it the other day, that if we just take the single category of things which are dependent or things which are caused, you cannot speak of them in the third turning of the wheel with the expression they don't exist by definition, because according to this school, they do exist by definition in the way that they describe by definition. So in the third turning of the wheel, when you describe caused things or dependent things as not having a nature, right, which is the first of the five characterizations, when you say that changing things don't have a nature, you cannot be referring to don't exist by definition in the general sense of the term. You have to explain don't have a nature as referring specifically to the fact that they don't have a nature of occurring or arising without their own causes and conditions. And you cannot use the wording don't exist by definition. You have to say don't have a nature, which is the first of the five characterizations, right? And you have to say don't have a nature means don't have a nature of occurring independent of their causes and conditions. That's just one example. You remember from the other day, we went through this whole thing with regard to those, and I don't have to go into a great detail. That's just one example of how that expression, which is the first one, doesn't have a nature, right? It has to be adjusted when you get to the third turning of the wheel with regard to the second group, which is dependent things. So you get, he says, I hope you're getting it then. I hope you are understanding that the same wording is used in the third turning of the wheel as used in the second turning of the wheel. The wording in the third turning of the wheel is the same, for example, for the first one, which is that things don't have any nature of their own. Things don't have any nature. And when you get to the third turning of the wheel, second turning of the wheel, it's exactly the same thing. But then you realize, even if you just think about it yourself, you realize that when we move from the second turning of the wheel to the third turning of the wheel, you must adjust that the meaning of those same words. So even though it's the same phrasing, the same wording, you realize in your own mind, I hope, that you have to adjust the meaning of those words when you get to the third turn of the wheel, and when you start describing the other characteristics as well, the other four, that you have to adjust them according to what wheel you're in.
Okay.
Are you okay? It's okay? Got it? So you do appreciate that remember before when we split those five into two groups, we treated doesn't have a nature by itself, and then we treated doesn't grow by itself, doesn't stop by itself separately. And with regard to the middle turning of the wheel, we did it in a certain way. And now you're sensitive to the fact that even if we make the same division of one and four, when we get to the third turning of the wheel, we're going to have to interpret this one differently, and then there's going to be a corresponding reinterpretation of the other four. But they have to be treated differently in the final turn of the wheel than they were in the second turn of the wheel, even though we maybe still will retain that distinction of one and four.
Okay.
Yes, sir. So if we were to go about and try to identify the particular disciple or student for whom the third turning of the wheel was specifically designed, right? Then remember, in the first turning of the wheel, we were talking about people who belong to the listener group, right? People who had entered the path of the listeners, which sort of implies Theravada, right? And then in the second turning of the wheel, this was designed for people who have entered the path of the greater way. Now when you get to the third turning of the wheel, you have to, the students or disciples for whom this turning of the wheel was specifically spoken are students of all of all the paths, of all the yanas, students of all the ways. So meaning both Mahayana and listener, meaning Theravada. So the third turning of the wheel, the specific disciples are disciples of all the different ways.
Okay.
Now, different masters of the past and even nowadays have taken two different, I guess I like to go like that, you know, two different ideas about what it means to, when the Buddha says, oh, the students for this are all yanas, right? All people of all the ways, you know, and some masters have said, and then Geshe-la was pointing like this, you know, you've got the Hinayana and the Mahayana, and some people have taken it to mean Hinayana and Mahayana. Because he was sticking out four fingers, I said, are you talking about the four classical schools of India? He said, no, I didn't mean to do that, you know, it's just Hinayana and Mahayana. So when we say students of all the yanas, that the third turn of the wheel was designed for students of all the yanas, we were talking about both Hinayana and Mahayana students. Some people say that. So some people have expressed the idea that they feel very uncomfortable with the idea of explaining that when it says here people of all the different ways, that they are meaning yana, right? That they are talking about students of both the Mahayana and the Hinayana, because they say there incurs the problem that then everything the Buddha spoke during the third turning of the wheel would have to become both Hinayana teachings and Mahayana teaching at the same time. So they don't feel comfortable with that. They don't feel comfortable with the idea of defining the students for whom the third turning of the wheel was designed as, and when the Buddha says it was people of all ways, they have a problem with calling that all ways, meaning all Hinayana and all Mahayana ways, because then that teaching itself, normally you have to divide the Buddha's teachings into either Mahayana teaching, this was a Mahayana teaching, this was a Hinayana teaching. They don't feel comfortable with saying the third turning of the wheel was a mix, or it's not 50% Mahayana teaching, 50% Hinayana teaching. You know, normally there's a group of students, the Buddha either brings up Mahayana ideals or Hinayana ideals, but what are you going to call a teaching? How are you going to, if you describe the students as being 50-50, then how are you going to call the teaching? Is that going to be a teaching that was 50% Mahayana ideals and 50% Hinayana ideals? And how are you going to do that? They don't feel comfortable with that way of explaining the wording. This was designed for all ways, students of all ways. Some other scholars, this is getting hard, okay? Some other scholars have made a very, very beautiful idea about this whole question. You know, the ones who were uncomfortable with the first, the way of explaining it, and they've come up with a very beautiful way of explaining it. They say that the students, the disciples for whom the second and third turnings of the wheel were designed were all mind-only school. Okay? And there were two sections of mind-only school students. Okay? There were the better mind-only students and the slower mind-only students. Okay? And among them, the better mind-only students went into the second turning of the wheel. They go directly into the subject matter of the second turning of the wheel, and they get it right away. These are the more intelligent or the faster or the quicker mind-only students. And they go into the second turning of the wheel, and right away they understand its content. You know, they don't need any further explanation. They get it according to a mind-only way, right? Right away, and they don't need any further clarification. But then there are mind-only students who are a little bit slower. They can't go into the second turning of the wheel directly and grasp it right away. So they've got to go to the third turning of the wheel. And by studying the contents of the third turning of the wheel, by understanding it, by thoroughly practicing and understanding all the contents of the third turning of the wheel, then they are able to go back and revisit the second turning of the wheel and then finally grasp its contents only later, right? Because of their extensive study of the third turning of the wheel, these slower mind-only students are able to go back to the second turning of the wheel and understand its contents. And then by implication, they are able to understand the contents of the first turning of the wheel. Because they got the second turning of the wheel down so well that now they understand the contents of the first turning of the wheel, and these become something that people that we can characterize as people of all ways. Because now they are masters of all three turnings of the wheel through this process. Okay, so then we call them people who have entered all the ways. So then these other scholars explain the expression people of all the ways in this particular method, and kind of cute, he said. I don't like that.
Nibidi.
No, sir. Nothing. Pumbo la sopa. Okay, here we go. That whole second concept that people came up with about the meaning of having entered into all three ways, right, has its evidence, or there's some backup for it, here in Jetsam Kapa's own text. So if you go to page 89, and you start out around line 6, you can get a backup for it from Jetsam Kapa himself. And what they're saying is that if you take dashi, he says, for example, but or you could take the five heaps of a person, the five parts of a person, then it is explained in the third turning of the wheel that the meaning of the second turning of the wheel, right? It's explained in the third turning of the wheel that the meaning of the second turning of the wheel is that if you have this person named Tashi, right, and he's an example of a dependent thing, and then you take the construct which applies to him, Which construct are we talking about? The fact that Tashi is what we call Tashi, okay? The fact that Tashi is what we give the name Tashi, right? So the construct that relates to the guide Tashi is the idea that Tashi is the thing that you call Tashi, okay? Does that exist by definition or not? It suppose that you had, somebody got an idea that it did, right? Suppose you take the idea, or the theoretical object called the fact that Tashi is the person to whom the word Tashi refers could exist by definition, right? Which is a non-existent thing. I'll say it again. The fact that the word Tashi refers to the person, the fact that Tashi is the thing that which the word, to which the word Tashi is used, the fact that that fact could exist by definition is a non-existent construct. That's actually the gakcha. That's the gakcha of what we call, that gakcha is defined as that thing of which emptiness is empty is described as the self-nature of things or of objects as opposed to a person, right? So that's the self-nature of a thing. So when the second turning of the wheel, the third turning of the wheel explains the meaning of the second turning of the wheel in those terms. Oh, the Buddha was talking about things that change. The Buddha was talking about the fact that those particular things are the object of what's given the name, their names, right? The fact that they are what are named them. The fact that that fact doesn't exist by definition, which if it did exist by definition would be the self-nature of things. And the fact that that doesn't exist is emptiness itself, okay? So that's emptiness. That's how we explain how the second turning of the wheel really is talking about emptiness, okay? So somebody goes, gets the third turning of the wheel and understands the second turning of the wheel in that sense. This is what this whole quotation is saying here. Then they can go back to the first turning of the wheel and understand that when the Buddha said that things had self-nature or something like that, they can understand that he wasn't really speaking literally, that he was describing actually a similar process. You take changing things, you look at their at how you make a construct about them, and the fact that those constructs, which were not exactly the construct I just stated, right, which is that the thing is the object of the thing of its name, right? But you take more what we call its kansaki dharma, which is the lack of a self, of a person to that thing, and that if you understand the three attributes, and if you understand how emptiness or totality is arrived at by refusing the self nature of a person with regard to changing things, right, or of a person in this case, the five heaps, let's say, then you've arrived at an emptiness or a yongdrupa totality in the first turning of the wheel. So by understanding clearly how you arrive at an emptiness in the second turning of the wheel, by using the third turning of the wheel, and then taking that information and going back to the first turning of the wheel and understanding how you arrive at emptiness in the first turning of the wheel, the emptiness arrived at in the second turning of the wheel being the lack of a self-existence of things or objects, the emptiness in the first turning of the wheel being the lack of self-existence to people or persons, and then you go along to the third turning of the wheel and you understand all that stuff, right? Due to your understanding of the third turning of the wheel, you understand all that stuff. Now we're on page 90, okay? Then by that time, a person who's gone through that process is the kind of person for whom the third turning of the wheel, which is called the turning of the wheel of fine distinctions, okay? You got to get used to that expression. When we say the turning of the wheel of the Dharma in which the Buddha made fine distinctions, that's referring to his describing his words of things that have no nature into those three groups of the mind only school, right? That's called the turning of the wheel in which the Buddha made fine distinctions. So if you take a person who has to go to the turning of the wheel in which the Buddha made fine distinctions in order to understand the content of the second turning of the wheel, which helps him understand the content of the first turning of the wheel, then that kind of person is the person that we describe as having entered all the ways. Okay? Phew. Okay? And then that's the person that the Buddha is talking about here when he says people have entered all the ways. And that's where those scholars who think that that doesn't just refer to people who have entered all the yanas, right? But rather people who have entered all three methods or all three ways in this sense, that's where they get their scriptural reference. And I just brought that out because, I skip back to page 89 because I have this fear that we're not going to get there. We are moseying along on feet and we don't even have an old Indian bicycle to ride on. And, you know, we're just kind of walking along slowly and, you know, much less a car. So I don't think we might get to that point, so I just thought it'd be worth it to jump back there and say, this is where they're proving that idea, that second idea that people had about the meaning of having entered all the ways, as being the description of people for whom the third turning of the wheel was designed. Okay. Oftentimes the third turning of the wheel is called the turning of the wheel in which the Buddha made fine distinctions, in which he made excellent distinctions. And what does that mean in terms of what we've been talking about? You have those three groups of things, what you call constructs, dependent things, and totality meaning emptiness. And out of those three, one of them doesn't exist by definition, and two of them do exist by definition, right? So that's a distinction that they're talking about when they say making fine distinctions. It's not into the three. It's taking the three as the basis and making a distinction between them and saying these two do exist by, what was it? Do exist by definition, and this one doesn't exist by definition. And it's making that distinction that's referred to when they say that the third turning of the wheel is the turning of the wheel in which the Buddha made fine distinctions. So again, we take those four characterizations, right, and we pancake them over, we flip-flop them over. So remember the first one was, does have something better than it, does have something higher than it. In this case, higher than it refers to something higher than it, which is literal in its meaning and not figurative in its meaning. But when we get to the third turning of the wheel, since this is the literal one in this school, right, there's nothing above it, right? There's nothing you can characterize as, this is a literal teaching, which is above, due to its literalness, is above the other ones, right? So the first and the second turning of the wheels are below, in a sense, because they're not literal. And then the third one, is being literal, is higher. But when you get to the third turning of the wheel, you have to say lana machipa, which means there is nothing higher, because there's nothing higher which is literal, because the other two aren't literal. And then the third tier of the wheel is described as being leaves no opening, right? You don't leave any opening for someone else to give any trouble or to give you any argument. The first two turnings of the wheel, if you take them literally, right, if you take the first one as literal, if you take the second one as literal, then in a sense you are opening yourself up for criticism. Someone can attack you, someone can point out a problem with your viewpoint, and you're leaving yourself open. But if you go and take the third turning of the wheel as something literal, you are not leaving yourself open. So it's said there that you are not leaving yourself open. Kapmachipa means you are not leaving an opening. You're not leaving yourself an opening, are you? No one can attack you and say, oh, your viewpoint is stupid. If you take the third turn of the wheel literally, oh, your viewpoint is stupid, you're wrong, you made a mistake, you have a philosophical problem here. Can you? Oh, but wait a minute, you can. You know, people from the Madhyamika school, middleway school, can come up to you and say, hey, no, you're wrong, you know, hey, there's a problem there. You think those two groups exist by definition, right? Changing things and ultimate, you know, emptiness, right? And you think that other one doesn't exist by definition. And so you do have a problem. So somebody can attack you, and you are having an opening. So should they have called this not having an opening? Yes, they can call it not having an opening. Because remember, we're stuck in the mind-only school, and no smart person of the mind-only school could come and attack you. So when we say you don't have an opening, we're not saying you don't have an opening for anybody in the universe to complain about you or criticize your philosophical view. We're talking about there's no opening for a smart guy in the mind-only school to come and attack you, because in the mind-only school's terms, you're clean. You know, the wording here was no opening for a smart person or a master to attack you. And if you take this literally, you got a little bit of a problem, because then those Madhyamika guys become non-masters, not very smart, you know. So it's a little bit of a problem here. The wording's a little tricky here. So that Kepa Dila said sometimes the Kepas get sick, lost in human life. Nothing. Okay. Nothing. So Geshe-la says, you know, all that stuff I just told you, you can go back to the text, you can find it right here. Page 31, sixth line to the bottom. It says, And what it says there exactly, directly, is that if you're a person who takes the first two turnings of the wheel literally, then you could have, someone could come and it would leave an opening for someone to come and attack you and complain about what you said. But the third turning of the wheel is not like that. If you took it literally, you would not leave an opening for any master, any smart person, which is the word kepa in the next to last line of page 31. No one who really knows what they're talking about could come and attack you, you know? So that's where I got that thing from when I said smart person or someone who knows what they're talking about. And again, remember that we're talking here, Simtapa Shirshat means we're restricting ourselves to the mind-only school, right? And from the mind-only school, maybe the people from the middleway school can be characterized as not knowing what they're talking about, okay? Why is it that a mind-only school person thinks they can go up to a middleway person's school and say, oh, you don't really know what you're not the kind of person who really knows what they're talking about, right? It's because they look at the middleway school people and say, you middleway school people, how do you relate to the second turning of the wheel? And the middleway people say, oh yeah, everything the Buddha said there was literal. We are to take everything the Buddha said during the second turning of the wheel as being literal. And then the mind-only school says, you didn't get it. You know, you really didn't get it. In the second turning of the wheel, the Buddha was describing three groups of things, or three attributes. Those are constructs, dependent things and totality, what we call emptiness. And then the Buddha went about, what his real intent was to say that, you know, the constructs don't exist by definition, but his real intent was to say that the other two groups do exist by definition. So, you know, you guys didn't really get the whole point, what the Buddha really had in mind. And so from our point of view, you really don't know what you're talking about. You are not masters. You are not smart guys. You are in that category, from our point of view, of people who don't really know what they're talking about. The third characterization, which is going to flip over from that was figurative to that was literal, right? So what in the first two turns of the wheel, we said that they were figurative, and we said that in the mind-only school, figurative means that we are not to take it on face value. We are not to take it, take the words as meaning what the words say. We are meant to interpret the words. But then we get to the third turn of the wheel, we are to take it on face value, so the characterization changes from figurative to literal. So in the third turn of the wheel, whatever the Buddha said is what he really meant, and we are to take those on face value. We are to accept the words as the Buddha spoke them, and that's why we can characterize, make the third characterization about the third turning of the wheel and say it was literal, that the Buddha meant it literally. In this school. The last characterization that we flip-flop over, right, is that that thing which was an object of contention in the first and second of the turning of the wheels, now when we get to the third turning of the wheel, we say the third turning of the wheel cannot act as a basis for contention. There will be no contention about the third turning of the wheel. It is something which is not a what do you call basis for contention, right? So it doesn't act as a base for contention. What do they mean when they say that? When he got to the first turning of the wheel, Lord Buddha made a blanket statement. He said all of these things exist by definition, but in reality, what he meant was some of them do and some of them don't. So you have to go in there. There's contention about it. Different people have to go in and make different contending statements about, oh, he meant that one was existing by definition. He meant that one wasn't existing by definition. The same holds true of the second turn of the wheel. He made a blanket statement in the second turn of the wheel that nothing exists by definition. But what he really meant was that some things do and some things don't. And again, there can be contention about it. You know, so different people with different points of view can come in and say, this one he meant should be taken by definition. This one doesn't exist by definition. This one does exist by definition. And those things are an object of contention. But when you get to the third turn of the wheel, he was totally clear, totally definitive, he totally divided things. He said, these things do exist by definition. None of these things exist by definition. And he is very clear to make these absolute distinctions between all the things he was talking about. These things now I say exist by definition. These things now I say don't exist by definition. And because he was clear, and because he definitively made these distinctions between them, there's no object of contention anymore. There's nothing to argue about anymore. And that's why the fourth characterization is applied to the third turning of the wheel, which is that there's no longer any basis or object of contention.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have Jetsun Kapa's take on that Chinese commentary, right? The Chinese commentator Wen Si, right? And he's trying to remember we said that he would be giving his version of what the four characterizations meant, and that some of them would be similar to our version, Jetsun Kapa's version, and some of them wouldn't be similar to Jetsun Kapa's version. So here on page 29 at the top in the first line, we go off on Wen Six's version, the Chinese commentary's version. Remember, Chinese commentary to what? To the sutra in which the Buddha explained the meaning of his sutras, right? So this has occurred before Jetsun Kapa, right? And so he's making his idea. First he says, Lana Chipa means there is a better, meaning there was a more extraordinary teaching. So he explains it in those general terms. So that's pretty close to us when we say there is something better, meaning there is a sutra teaching which is literal, which is better. You see what I mean? There is above these first two a third one which is higher in the sense of being literal. So when Wensik says, when Master Wensik says there is a higher one in the sense of a more extraordinary one or a more special one, then he's okay there, okay? But then he goes on to the second one, which is there is an opening or there is an occasion, right? And he takes it more in the sense of an occasion for teaching and in the sense of an occasion, an opening or an opportunity for a more special teaching, okay? So then again, he's characterizing the third, when he uses it with regard to the third theory of the wheel, he's calling that a more extraordinary teaching. And that's what he means by there's an opening or an opportunity, meaning there's a higher opportunity, there's a more special teaching. Now, Geshe-la says, Jetsun Kapa's problem with this way of describing it, and you can appreciate it, is that there's no real difference between the first one and the second one now, right? So in the first one he's saying, by virtue of there being a more special teaching, there's something higher because there's a special teaching higher. And then he gets the second one, he says, there's an opening because there's another occasion on which he's going to give a more special teaching. He hasn't really, aside from a distinction in the wording, you know, he's used slightly different words, the meaning is exactly the same. So you're not getting any, why would Lord Buddha say two different characterizations if there weren't any big difference or no flavor, big flavor difference between those two? So that's why Jetsun Kapa doesn't feel comfortable with the way in which the Chinese commentary treats that, the meaning of those four characterizations, the first two. The Chinaman Wensi goes on, Master Wensi goes on to explain the third characterization, which was figurative. They are figurative. And then later when we flip-flop it, it's literal, right? And he says, oh, the meaning of being figurative here is two requirements, okay? First one, that it does not teach emptiness. Secondly, that it does teach something which exists, okay? doesn't teach emptiness, and does teach something which exists. Okay. Now, if you think about it, that's pretty close to what later on the Middle Way school is going to say. Figurative means doesn't teach emptiness, but does teach something exists. That gets close to how the Middle Way school explains what it is to be figurative. And then, if you take literal to mean does teach emptiness, right? That gets pretty close to the way. To the way that the Middle Way people are going to describe it. But he says, when Jetsun Khapa's problem with Wenzig's interpretation here is that he seems to be forgetting we're in the mind-only school, okay? Like, mind-only school describes figurative as being something which is not literal, a case where you cannot take it on the face value of the word. You cannot follow the literal meaning of the word. You cannot take it word by word as the wording states. So Jetsun Khapa says, I don't think that's a correct way of explaining how the mind-only school explains what it means to be figurative in the way that figurative is used here among the four characterizations, which are spoken by the mind-only school, from the mind-only school point of view. Okay. He keeps saying, let's just skip this because you guys don't have time. I keep saying, do it well, we'll come back. Okay, yeah. There's a very small point here, a very small point. And he says, let's skip it. And I said, don't skip anything. And then he said, okay. When the Chinese commentary talks about occasion, right, he does at that, remind out of the four, right, the second one, when he mentions occasion, the Chinese commentary does have this small phrase that says guo dan qiapa. Guo dan qiapa means there is some guo means like debate about it. Gulwa. Ragataga. Right. Debate about it. You know, like tasatan means debating. So there is a Jetsun Khapa likes the phrase that apparently the Chinese commentary is flirting with or using a certain phrasing that says that mentions there is some dispute. And he says, now that phrasing I like, if he's talking about the opening, the occasion, and if he's characterizing it as having some debate about it, in a very, very tiny little phrase, he says, that sounds good to me, I like that kind of wording. Okay. Then there's another he says, if you think about the second turning of the wheel and the third turning of the wheel, they are both treating the object, the subject of emptiness. They're both treating emptiness. They're talking about emptiness. In the Chinese commentary, especially when they turn it into, translate it into to Tibetan, there comes out a phrase called the aspect which is not very apparent, okay? The aspect which is not apparent. And in the same way that word, he liked the wording as it was translated in Tibetan from the Chinese commentary that said, there's some debate, right? There's some debate. And then Geshe-la says, I don't know how that comes out in English, but it's good in Tibetan. You see, if the Chinese rendering can be translated into Tibetan as, there's some debate, and if they're talking about that opening, then he likes it, Jetsukhava likes it. And I hope that the English word that comes out of the Tibetan rendering there, you know, has the same flavor of being very appropriate for that opening, the word opening. But now we're going on to the description of the second and third turnings of the wheel, wherein they are described as having an aspect which is not apparent. And here too, in the way that the Chinese commentary gets rendered into Tibetan, Jetsukhava is saying, I like that. I like that. Because it's like, you can say about emptiness that it has an aspect of not being apparent. And also you can talk about it being described clearly or not being described clearly, and then you would get into apparentness or non-apparentness. So the idea of about emptiness itself being not apparent and also being able to describe it in terms that are apparent or not, so that it becomes apparent, if you talk about emptiness in terms of having an aspect which is not apparent, then they kind of like this phrasing. Jezokov says, I kind of like this phrasing from the Chinese commentary. Lo San Chenzin is forcing me to treat all the small issues also. I'm not sure that all the fine details are something that is going to really help you much, but let's go ahead and do them. There's another small point. I just want to throw out all those small points to you. Jetsun Kapa on page 30, in the sixth line at the end where he says Dinu Sumba. First of all, to call, he's referring to the Chinese master Wenzi. And when he calls him Dinu Sumba, it's a compliment. Dinu Sum means the three pitakas, Tripitaka, right? The three baskets of scripture. And he's referring to him as a total master of the basket of sutra, the basket of Abhidharma, and the basket of Vinaya. So he's giving him those three. He's giving him a very complimentary term. He's saying, oh, that master of the three baskets, right? And then he says, Wensik. And then he says, you know, when he got to those four characterizations with regard to the first two turnings of the wheel, I think he did a really good job because he did at least talk about the four. You know, he did talk about what it meant to be, what was the first one? Something higher than it, and then there is an opening, and then it is a figurative thing. And then what was the last one? Oh, and there's no subject, no object of dispute, right? And he did, when he did describe those in pretty clear terms. I mean, he doesn't agree with the interpretation, right? But at least he did treat those four with regard to the first turning of the wheel, and he did treat those four with regard to the second turning of the wheel. But you know what? When he got to the third turning of the wheel, he did not treat the flip-flops, okay? He did not go to the pancaked ones, you know, the ones where each one of the four was reversed, and treat them very clearly. And that's another problem Jetsun Kapa has with his explanation.
Mm-hmm.
The Sumbanama Sigure Sumkalonaya, Sumyore. Colo Sungolo Sigure, Colo Sumbanama, then there's an Indian master named in Tibetan the word is Yanda Denpa. I have to check. You know, Clinton? I don't know what the it's by Samyak something. But he also wrote a commentary on this commentary in which the Buddha explained the meaning of his other sutra in which the Buddha explained the meaning of his other sutras. He also wrote a commentary. But when he got to this part about the third tree of the wheel and those four characteristics, he did attempt an explanation. Jetsudapa doesn't like it. He says he doesn't think he was like thinking very clearly or working very hard on it, or he didn't make very great distinctions about it. He didn't really make a very good job of it. So I'm not even going to bother to write about it here. We've already been through it. We explained it in detail already. Take each one of the four, reverse it, and you get Jetsudapa's system. And he too here says, what's my system? I already told you what my system is. We already went over that. He leaves it at that. I'm going to give you all those small ones because you asked for it. Now remember that Jetsudapa had promised to tell you what the subject matter of the third chain of the wheel is, but he didn't get there yet. So this is where he gets there. And he says, by the way, the subject matter of the third turning of the wheel is exactly the same as the subject matter of the second turning of the wheel. So that's all he has to say about it, you know. And Geshe-la says, don't forget, he's going back to the sutra, he's ripping it apart, he's going through it piece by piece, and now he's reached the point where he has to tell you the subject matter of the third turning of the wheel. He says, it's exactly the same as in the second turning of the wheel. I already talked to you about that. Then Jetsudapa gets on to the part in the sutra where the Buddha says, you know, it says, for whom was the third turning of the wheel designed or specifically spoken? And then it says, remember, it says, for those who have entered all the ways. And then Jetsudapa says, Namanini, meaning the former two, meaning the first two turnings of the wheel, were directed towards specifically disciples of, he says, Tepa Chetum, Sosowa, meaning individually for students of, first of all, the lower way, second of all, the higher way, right? And then Jetsudapa himself says, and Dini meaning this one as opposed to those, right? So from the point of view of the third turn of the wheel, Dini, this one means the third one, right? If you're sitting in the third one, it becomes the closer one, and you can refer to it as this one. And then those other two. So the other two refers to the first two turnings of the wheel. This one refers to the third turning of the wheel. And then Jetsudapa says, this one was spoken with regard to both. Both those of the higher way and those of the lower way. And that's Jetsudapa's briefer way of describing it. Mm-hmm. So remember we had that hassle about what does it mean that dosa have entered all the ways, right? We had that wording, dosa have entered all the ways before. And then we had those two ideas. You know, one guy went off and said, it refers to people of Mahayana Hinayana. The other guy went off and had this complicated explanation, beautiful, complicated explanation of how it referred to minority people like that. Well, those guys who like this version of it, they point to this part of the text when they're trying to defend their version. Because here it seems to say, this one, meaning the third turning of the wheel, relates to both. So they like to pull out this page and show it to people to support their idea. And those guys that went off on the other tangent like to go back to page 80, whatever it was, and say, no, here's where he agrees to our system, and that's the one that we like. And then Geshe-la says, who knows? I don't know, who knows? Those smart people of the past probably know what it is. Though. Who do I know? You know, I don't know anything. This reminds me what that we just talked about, that there was a hassle yesterday that we didn't quite resolve, you know? I said that we were going to resolve it today. There was a point where there were two different ideas going on, and I promised you we'd attempt to resolve it. Of course, who knows if we can resolve it? You know, resolving is hard, but it seems to me I remember we had an issue from yesterday that we promised we were going to talk about and resolve, and I said I would resolve it with you, and now we're going to kind of run short of time again to resolve that, but we will resolve it. So remind me, we'll get back to that one, or we'll try to cover that one. There was this thing where there were two different systems about something, and I was going to help you resolve it and clean it up, and we didn't do it, and we were going to do it today, and I kind of forgot to do it, and now we're getting short of time, but we'll see about doing that one. I think I asked you guys to make a mark. What was it about? He knows what it is. You don't have to remind me. Okay, don't worry about it. Don't mash potatoes. If we get time, we'll let this problem arise again. If we don't get time, we'll let it lie like a sleeping dog. Something like that. Again, Geshe-la is going back to that word on the fifth line from the bottom on page 30 where he says, now this one, okay, in Tibet we call it a proximity, a word of proximity, meaning this thing is close to us. When you say this one, it means something close. When you say those, or those old ones, you're talking about something far away. So this is a proximity expression, an expression of proximity. Why? Where are we in the sutta? Do you remember? The Bodhisattva has just got through asking these questions of the Buddha. And then, what did you mean when you talked about the first, second turning wheel, blah, blah, blah. And then Lord Buddha has come back and he's given all these answers and all these answers. So if you think about it, in the book, or sutrically, you know, we are located after the Buddha's extensive answer, after Lord Buddha's answer. So if you take it by proximity, the first two turnings of the wheels are way back there. And then that question and those replies, responses, are right here coming up against us. So by proximity, you can refer to the third turning of the wheel from our point of view now as being dini, meaning now this one, meaning the closer one. Now, no problem to refer to this third turning of the wheel as now this one, okay? So how do we define? You know, we've been throwing these terms around very easily. First turning of the wheel, second turning of the wheel, third turning of the wheel. How do we define those turnings of the wheel? What is it that is the turning of the wheel? Who decided this is first, second, third turning of the wheel? Okay. And then Geshe-la points out that on page 31 in the first line, we have that sutra in which the Buddha explained the meaning of his sutras, right? What he had in mind when he spoke the other sutras, being referred to as, you know, in English we usually translate it as the commentary on my true thought or something like that, commentary on what I really intended to say, right? Here, Jetsun Kapa is referring to that book with the name Commentary on the True Thought of the Turnings of the Wheel. Okay, so Kolo Gongdel as a unit means commentary on the true thought of my three turnings of the wheel. You see what I mean? Of the turnings of the wheel. Now he says there's a big debate about how different people explain. How do we decide what is first turning of the wheel, second turning of the wheel, third turning of the wheel? What does it mean when we talk about a turning of the wheel? And some people have gone on, they don't use the expression first turning of the wheel, second turning of the wheel, third turning of the wheel. They talk about first turning of the wheel, which relates to the first outcome of the exchange. Second turning of the wheel as it relates to the second outcome of the exchange. Third turning of the wheel as it relates to the third outcome of the exchange. Remember that outcome of the exchange referred to after the Bodhisattva asked the Buddha the question, and then after the Buddha answered the question, there was an outcome. What was the outcome? We were able to decide. What was the profit from the transaction, in a sense? We were able to determine or decide that the first two turnings of the wheel were figurative, and that the third turning of the wheel was literal. So then there's some masters of the past, some great Buddhist scholars have said, first turning of the wheel, first outcome. Second turning of the wheel, second outcome. Third turning of the wheel, third outcome. And they've characterized them like that. Geshe-la hasn't gone in yet to what the three outcomes are, okay? He hasn't divided them like. Then he said, oh, there's something I forgot to tell you guys. Okay, some people say that it's the Dode Gongdrel itself. It's that sutra in which the Buddha explained the intent of his other sutras, which is the third turning of the wheel. So you can say that this sutra in itself is the third turning of the wheel. But I forgot to tell you guys the other day, this sutra has 10 different sections, 10 different chapters. Okay, and there's only one chapter called the chapter which was given at the request of the Bodhisattva named Dendan Yanda Pat. Okay, so when we talk about the third turning of the wheel, or everything we've described so far, is really coming out of one chapter of that sutra in which he explained the meaning of his sutras, which is called the chapter that was spoken at the request of or because of a question given by the Bodhisattva Dendam Yanda Pak. So Geshe-la wants to say that we made that distinction. Now we have different scholars coming along and having different ideas about what it is that defines three different turnings of the wheel, And here we go on how different people do it. And he brushed on one, comparing them to the three outcomes. Okay. So we've come to a point where some masters of the past have said the content of the third turning of the wheel is exclusively that chapter which was taught by Dhinayanapa. I mean, which was taught at the request or because of the question of Dhinayanapa. But then you have other scholars coming along and saying, other masters coming along and saying, no, it's not just that one section. It's any other teaching of the Buddha which has a similar content, okay, as that one section. Okay, so you can take not only that section as the third turning of the wheel, but any other teaching of the Buddha which is similar or which concurs or concordant with that one section, then you can expand the definition of the third or the description of the third turning of the wheel to say all those other books too. And then they point to Jetsun Kapa here saying, line 3, page 31, oh, other similar works or other similar teachings can be described as the third turning of the wheel. So there's a debate about it. There's two positions expressed here. Hey, I don't know. Whatever. How does Jetsun Kapa feel about it? How does Jetsun Kapa want to decide the question? Jetsun Kapa says, look, whatever. If a book divides things into these three groups, right? Constructs, things which are dependent, and then totality meaning emptiness, okay? Suppose any book takes that and then goes into those three categories and says that these two exist by definition and this one doesn't exist by definition, right? Well, then any book that does that, any teaching that does that, that's enough. Then we can say that's the third turning of the wheel, okay? And that's all I need, personally, says Jetsun Kapa, for something to be the third turning of the wheel. A speech of the Buddha, right? So again, Geshe-la says, you know, go back to one group saying that the third turning of the wheel is only that section which was requested by the Bodhisattva Dhinayanapa. And other people saying, well, it's anything similar to that. And I don't know, I don't really know which one we're going to go with. Here you have to know that I've been translating as the third turning of the wheel half the time. The real expression in Tibetan is the last turning of the wheel. Okay, so it's called Kolotama. So either it's called Kolosumba or Kolotama. Third turning of the wheel, sometimes it's called last turning of the wheel. Now, when you hear the wording last turning of the wheel, you might very naturally be tempted to think that it means the last one historically that the Buddha taught, right? Last turning of the wheel must be the last one he taught. And Jetsun Kapa says, don't make that mistake, okay? Just because we call it the last turning of the wheel doesn't mean that if something is the teaching of the Buddha that he taught last, that now automatically qualifies as the last turning of the wheel. Last turning of the wheel, according to Jetsun Kapa's viewpoint, is any book in which any teaching in which Lord Buddha spoke about those three groups and then said, oh, these are exist by definition, and these don't exist by definition. And any book in which he did that is the final turning of the wheel. And don't think that final, in this case, refers to some historical finality, where, you know, historically it was the final or last teachings that he gave. It's not true that everything that belongs to the final period of the Buddhist teachings is to be considered in the final turning of the wheel. The rest of page 31 we've been through. We went through it in pretty great detail. We skipped to it before, and we've gone through that, and we've been through the content of page 31. Now on the last line of page 31 we get to section number 2. It's called section number 2, in which we are going to talk about the names that are given to the three turnings of the wheel. Okay, so the three turnings of the wheel each get separate names, or they're given separate names. First of all, Jetsun Kapa goes into three names that were given to the three turnings of the wheel by the Chinese master. Okay, so the Chinese master has given, in his commentary, you find the three turnings of the wheel named three different things. First one is called the first turning of the wheel, comma, the turning of the wheel in which he taught the four Arya truths. Okay? And then the second turning of the wheel, comma, the one in which he said nothing has any nature or any characteristics of its own. And then the third turning of the wheel, which the Chinese master refers to as ascertaining the ultimate. Okay? Ascertaining the ultimate as the third turning of the wheel. And these are the names which the Chinese master gives to the three turnings of the wheel. So it appears that the Chinese master has been giving the name to the first turning of the wheel from its subject matter. The subject matter of the first turning of the wheel is the four Arya truths, and so the first turning of the wheel gets to be called the four Arya truths, the turning of the wheel in which the Buddha taught the four Arya truths. And the reason why the second turning of the wheel is called the turning of the wheel in which nothing has any characteristics or nature of its own, in Tibetan, that's a short way of saying there's nothing that exists by definition. Okay, so rather than talking about subject matter, the name of the second turning of the wheel is taken from the fact that the Buddha, during the second turning of the wheel, said nothing has any definition of its own. Nothing exists by definition, right? So it's called the turning of the wheel in which there's no definitions, meaning existing by definition, and of course, as we said the other day, not meaning the words you use to define something or something like that, but not existing by definition. So that's how the second turning of the wheel gets its name. The name in the Chinese commentary of the third turning of the wheel is the third turning of the wheel, comma, in which we ascertain the ultimate. And the word ultimate here is a code word for emptiness itself. And so because the content, or because the third turning of the wheel is concentrating on the idea of emptiness, so talking about the idea of emptiness, then it has been given the name in the Chinese commentary, at least, the third turning of the wheel, comma, the turning of the wheel in which we ascertain emptiness. So Jetsun Kapa says, you know, I understand why the Chinese commentary gave the third turning of the wheel the name, you know, ascertain the ultimate or something like that. You know, it's not crazy. It has its own sense. You could call the third turning of the wheel like that. But if you really look at the sutra and look at the ways in which the Buddha characterized the third turning of the wheel, perhaps it's better that we refer to it as turning of the wheel in which fine distinctions were made, okay? The turning of the wheel in which fine distinctions were made. What are the fine distinctions? We talked about it before. Two of the groups of the three exist by definition. One of the groups doesn't exist by definition. You're making the distinction between existing, the groups that exist by definition and the groups that don't exist by definition. And that, therefore, Jetsun Kapa, I feel more comfortable with naming the third turning of the wheel, the turning of the wheel in which the Buddha made fine distinctions. Geshe-la says, I think it's better that we leave off here. We're about page 32. We're going to stop page 32, line 4, halfway through the line. Why? Because it would be, we're about to enter a very huge section in which there are no places to stop. Okay? So rather than getting into it and not being able to get into it properly, we'll stop there. And then tomorrow we'll start right there. Okay. You know, you could look at the three turnings of the wheels in a historical light as far as a sequence of time, and you could say, you know, you could go about saying, you know, it is possible to say the first turning of the wheel occurred from this point up to this point in the Buddha's life, when Lord Buddha was this many years old, up to the time when Lord Buddha was this many years old. That constitutes the first turning of the wheel, and then there's the second turning of the wheel and the third turning of the wheel. So, you know, people do talk about the first period, the second period, and the third period, and you can talk in those terms. You can say, oh, from this point in his life to this point in his life, this point in his life to this point in his life, this point in his life, and this point in his life. But that's not the main point when we talk about periods of the Buddha's teachings. What we're referring to there is huge convocations. They use the word in Tibetan, three convocations, meaning there were, like, you could divide out three major events in which a very, very huge amount of disciples came and witnessed a major teaching event, you know. So really, when we talk about the Buddha's teaching in terms of three turnings of the wheel, or three historical periods during the Buddha's life, we're talking about, and then Geshe-la says, you could say India, you could say Southern Continent, India, Jambudvipa, right? The Southern Continent, the world that we're supposed to be in, right? When the Buddha came to this world and gave major teaching events, and then the years surrounding those events, right? The period surrounding those events, those can be divided historically into three periods. First turning, second turning, third turning, first period, second period, third period. So it's not so much a question of from this year to that year or this year to that year. It's really the period in which this huge gathering and this huge Dharma teaching event happened. And then this gathering and then this gathering. And those are one way when the book talks about the first, second, and third convocations or gatherings, or when the book talks about the first, second, or third periods, what the book is talking about is really particular major teaching events during the Buddha's lifetime. So you can look at the three turnings of the wheel also from a sort of a historical point of view. He said the talk of the tape talked his thought, train of thought also. Varanasi said it's such a nyevare. Generally speaking, when you talk about the three turns of the wheel and three great convocations, right, three great gatherings of Dharma event, right, in this book and in similar books, we don't really get a clarification, well, in this book especially, we don't get a clarification of locale, except for in the first one. In the first one, they're talking about Varanasi and in that particular, place out in the countryside where that teaching was given. The locale for the second turn of the wheel is clear. We all know it. It's Vulture's Peak in Rajagiri, right? So that's pretty clear, and that's pretty well known, and that occurs, that's clearly stated where that convocation took place. The third one is said to have taken place in a town called Yangbachen. I don't remember the census for it. Do you? No. I'll look it up. Shrestavad or something like that. But anyway, we're trying to identify that. In trying to identify that, by the way, we know where Vulture's Peak is. It's often Bir someplace in India, right? But in identifying the locale of the third turn of the wheel, a town called Yangbachen, Geshe-la thinks it's up towards Nepal, in the region, somewhere around the Nepalese border, Indian border, that there was a town, there was a city called Shrestavadi or something. Yeah, anyway, I'll look it up. Shrestavadi. And that's where the third turning of the wheel took place. I can't really pinpoint the locale for you. Okay. I hope I got it right. Okay. When you think about the first turning of the wheel and the third turning of the wheel, the disciples for whom the wording was intended and the disciples for whom the content was intended are the same. Okay. Disi yore genya tomcha. Kolo dambo ki tsiksin ki tujudan, kolo dambo korangi dundagi dujan ni chipares. Ani sumba digi tesa da sumba digi dujan ni... Okay, we'll go back again because it was confusing. I didn't know if he was saying first and third were the same or something like that. The logic behind the first and the logic behind the third is the same in the following sense. The person for whom the wording was intended and the person for whom the content was intended are the same thing. Okay, so yeah, the persons he meant to hear the teaching and the persons he meant to get the teachings are the same. Okay, in the first turning of the wheel, that's the case. And it's the same case, not the same, right? But it's the same case in the third turning of the wheel. The wording, the wording, the expressions of the third, the wording that he used in the third turning of the wheel, the students for whom that wording was intended, and the students for whom the intent of the third turning of the wheel, the meaning of the third turning of the wheel was intended, are the same group of students, okay? So in the first turning of the wheel, it's the case, and in the third turning of the wheel, that's the case. I realized the mistake of my initial words, you know, that I was using Tibetan that kind of was indicating that the students for the first turning of the wheel are the same as the third turning of the wheel. I mean, that's how he started out saying, you know. And then I got confused. He said, no, wonder why you got confused. We just got through saying that the students for whom the third turning of the wheel were designed are students who have entered all the ways. And then students who are for whom the first turning of the wheel was designed are students who have entered the listener or Hinayana way. And now I come up and say, oh, they're all the same, you know. Everything was meant for the same people. Yeah, I understand why you got a doubt about it. Of course, what I meant to say was, the students for whom the wording of the first turn of the wheel was designed and the students for whom the content or the meaning of the first turn of the wheel was designed are the same group of people. And that same fact is true of the third turn of the wheel. Now that one in the middle, right? That one in the middle, that one line between. Now there's a different case, okay? There's a different case. You got one set of people for whom the wording was intended, and you have a totally different set of people for whom the meaning was intended. Okay, and now the middle one, that dude in the center, okay, he says. Now, who did he mean that one for? And how do we describe the students for whom that was designed for? Shut that mighty Mika door, don't leak out there, okay? Now, in the mind-only school system, the people for whom the wording was intended, okay, the wording was designed for people in the higher part of the middle way school, the consequence part of the middle way. For them, the Buddha was using those kinds of, that kind of language, that those kinds of wording, those kinds of expressions, the way in which he expressed the second turning of the wheel, the words that he used, were designed for the sake of the higher group, the consequence group of the Madhyamika middle way school. But the intent, the content, the meaning of his words, what the meanings were meant to express, the ideas that he meant to express, those were designed for us, for the mind-only school people, okay? Don't leak off into that door, he says. Those were designed for us, for the mind-only school. And that's what they think, okay? So now you have to sort of make a sort of fine distinction, don't we? Don't you think we have to make a distinction here? Don't forget, we are mind-only guys, right? Everybody here is a mind-only person, okay, right now. He says, don't forget, when they come to the second turning of the wheel, and they are discussing the question of who, for whom was the second turning of the wheel turned? Who was the disciple that the Buddha had in mind? To whom was it particularly designed or directed on the second turning of the wheel? You know, you can say that the people for whom the wording was directed, you know, the people for whom the verbiage or the words or the expressions of the second turning of the wheel were directed are the higher group, the consequence groups of the middle way school. But don't you have to say then that even though they were the disciples for whom the wording was designed, they are not disciples for whom the second turning of the wheel was designed. Don't you have to say that? If you're a minor league school person? Yeah, that's true, because you can say that the upper part of the Madhyamika school of people, they can be characterized as being people for whom the wording was specifically directed or designed. But you can't characterize them, therefore, as people for whom the second turning of the wheel was designed, because, you know, we can look at the second turning of the wheel as like a big ball, right? And us mind-only guys, you know, we're on the inside. We're right in the pits of the matter, you know? We understand everything about the real meaning of it, because we are inside circle, you know? We're right there in the center, and we got the pith of it. But those Madhyamika guys, they're looking for it from the outside, you know? They're just seeing the outer covering of the thing. They're just seeing the verbiage, or the expressions, or the words. That's all that they're getting out of it. They ain't getting the pith. So we can't describe them as the disciples for whom the second or the middle turning of the wheel was designed. Just that the wording was directed towards them, but the meaning was designed for us, the mind-only people. I'm just giving an example. I don't want you to start saying that Geshe Thupten Rinpoche said that the middle turn of the wheel is like an orange and it's got a peel on the outside. Some people are messing out the peel. Other people are in there in the middle eating the fruit. I don't want you to quote me like that, okay? I'm not saying the second turn of the wheel is some kind of weird, like a big fruit with a skin on the outside and something on the inside, okay? Please don't report me that way. Just kidding. Dying. So, you know, this stupid thing's going to go off shortly. You know, we don't have much time left. But we do have a little bit of time, so why not cover something, you know, that we... Let's go back to one of those old hassles we were having and just catch a little tidbit from it, okay? We'll just bite off a corner of one of those last hassles we had. Don't forget not to stick this in your notes as if it were now a new subject or something like that. Remind yourself in your notes, make a point that this, we're going back to something that we talked about before. This is not a new subject thing. It should be clear in your notes that you are now... we're now revisiting something that came before. Now, remember that we said that the different combinations of those three groups, right? Constructs, dependent things, and totality. That those three groupings or those three attributes could easily, and we did, describe them with reference to a changing thing, right? We used a changing thing as the basis. And then using that changing thing, we went very nicely through all the permutations of the three groups that allow us to define the three groups, okay? But then we said that Lord Buddha said that these three attributes apply to all existing things, which meant, do you remember, that they also apply to things that don't change. And there must be a way that you can use these three groups and some permutation of the three groups or some process by which you use the three groups to characterize unchanging things. We had said last time that we would come back and revisit that point, and we did not yet revisit that point, so here we go on that point. We said that there would be a little hassle about it, and now we'll go into that point. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I got a question for you guys. Remember that when he talked about the three groups before, we had established them with reference to one of the five heaps, really. You know, it's something like a changing thing. You could say like the physical matter or something like that. We did it with regard to a physical object, right? And then we went through that, and then the text said, well, you can apply this to the four kinds of sustenance, you can apply this to different categories of things, you can apply this to the 12 divisions of dependent origination, you can apply this to the 18 categories, and blah, blah, blah. It went on different things. Now, assume you guys have had some instruction in what we call the 12 doors of sense, right? Which means the, like, 12 objects and then 12 consciousnesses, or some, sorry, 6 and 6, right? 6 objects and 6 consciousnesses, which arise from those objects. So, now I want to ask you a question. This is, by the way, the first chapter of Abhidharma. We've never done it very clearly. Okay, sorry. It comes in the Heart Sutra also. But if you take those 12 categories, those 12 doors of sense, they're called, and if you look at them, can you guys tell me, among the 6 consciousnesses and their 6 objects, are they all exclusively changing things, or are there any unchanging things, do you think? I don't need some. You can just give me one. It's okay.
In the mind,
You're right.
I think what he's saying, although I'm not very clear on it, you said there was one unchanging thing, or you could come up with one unchanging thing that was the object of the ayatana, right? Of the door of sense of the mind, right? And how would you relate that to the shenwang that we were talking about the other day? Remember we had a shenwang the other day, we had a changing thing the other day. How would you relate that thing that you came up with to the shenwang that we were talking about the other day, to the changing thing, or to the dependent thing that we were talking about the other day?
The idea, the mental picture, has to be triggered by one of the other functioning things. The changing thing, as you said, shenwang is the thing that is taking triggers the mental construct.
And you're saying the construct is
permanent? You could have no object based on something which wasn't from
Maybe my question wasn't too clear. When we said that you can establish the category called dependent things with regard to the five heaps, using the five heaps as a basis, right? You can establish what shenwang is, right? Remember they all have their shenwang, they all have their kuntai, they all have their yungdu, right? So how was it that with regard to the five heaps we established their own group of dependent things, do you remember? Huh? Before we were establishing that all three categories or all three attributes can be said to apply to every changing object, and we used the five heaps as an example, and we came about, we were able to establish that all three attributes or all three groups apply to any particular changing object. Now, how are you going to relate that now? No. Yesterday I went through this similar process two times. Question. Kundati chuyu yimba dirbe. Kunchaki chuyu yimba. He's not asking you, can you look back and find it in your notes? His question is not boiling down to, did you write it down or not? Because he happens to know that you wrote it down. What I want to know is whether it was written in here or not. He wants to know, how can you establish the attribute called dependent things with regard to unchanging things, or with regard to the, it's not really Dhamma Dhatu, it's the door of sense called object of the mind. That whole group of stuff which is called object of the mind. As opposed to the object of the physical senses. So you've got 10, right? 5 and 5. 5 objects of the physical senses, 5 consciousness which are triggered by them, which is why they're called door of sense. And then you've got the mind itself, or thoughts, which are triggered by their own, the object of thoughts. So inside of those object of thoughts is an unchanging thing. Now how do you establish the existence of Shenwang, the third group, with regard to an unchanging thing? That's a little tricky. I don't know. Keep going. Let's come on, let's go. He says, don't be shy, go ahead. And whatever you want, just blast it out. That's an unchanging thing? Okay. Yeah, okay. Da pena yigi keje di yigi keje ki na sa na ka ke na na. He says it slipped down my mouth and don't translate it for him. I said don't worry, I don't even get it anyway. Na sa na na sa na do you remember the other day when we were discussing how to identify what it is to be a construct, right? We got into the identification of constructs. When we were talking about the identification of constructs, we brought up how the group of changing things or depending things relates to the identification of constructs. Later on, when we got to changing things themselves, and we were trying to identify what it is to be a member of that group, again we used the group of changing things or dependent things to describe or to characterize that group. How was it that we did that? In each case, we did it twice so far. We've done it twice. Ngarangi Seyadi, EKJD, Tape Yu Yangjin, Mitape Yu Yangjin Girwas, Mitape Dasa Yang, togro yi se adi tape chi yan togre mitape chi yan togre ta mitape chi tod ganiya di din chi to so se di kunta ke gone togre ane tape chi da tod ganiya kunta ke gone chi togre ta kunta se adi ta pare ne so how that you got to do a show on. No, but you said when the mind takes as an object of the mind an unchanging thing or a changing thing, and then you said when it takes as an object of the mind a changing thing, then it comes up with a mental picture with an unchanging thing. Where are you going to go from there? He wants to know how dependent things relate to talking of establishing the three groups with unchanging things. He says, looks to me like you probably found it in your nose or something.
Yeah.
You threw your pen down in your notebook at a certain spot, and it makes me believe that you found what you're looking for. Didn't we explain Shenwang or dependent things in terms of three different features? The arena in which constructs do their thing, right? In which they act. That thing which is the object of the labeling process, whichever one it is. And then that thing which exhibits the characteristic of a produced thing, right? Meaning it depends on its causes and conditions. Didn't we characterize dependent things in that way? Didn't we characterize cause things in that way? So write it down. I'm sorry. It's weird how people can't understand it when we're about to say something that, you know, and that they don't understand what we said already, as if it was something we said already. Everybody got that? You know, where we were last time? I mean, from yesterday, right? From the other day, when we talked about it's the arena in which constructs work. It's the thing which catches the labels. And then thirdly, it exhibits the qualities of a produced thing, right? Everybody got that? You know, where we were last time? I mean, from yesterday, right? From the other day, when we talked about it's the arena in which constructs work. It's the thing which catches the labels. And then thirdly, it exhibits the qualities of a produced thing, right? Everybody got that? Got that? You found it? Yeah.